Hi there, House Culture listener. If you enjoy this episode or have enjoyed listening to other episodes in our series, please support and donate to us through the Acast supporter feature. All donations will help us create the content that you love listening to. You can decide how much you give, and there is no regular commitment. So it could be a one-off, and every now and then, or once every time you listen, it's really up to you. Click on the supporter link in the episode description, and with Google or Apple Pay, it will take you less than 30 seconds to make your contribution.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey guys, I'm Topic and you are listening to the House Culture Podcast.
House Culture.
Hello everybody and welcome to the House Culture Podcast with me, your host, Matt Rouse, the Managing Editor at House Culture. As always, I'd like to thank you for lending us your ears for the next hour or so. This podcast simply wouldn't happen without your support, so please continue to tune in and spread the word. And if it's your first time here, I'd like to welcome you to House Culture. We are a collective of house music fans who have come together through their mutual love of the beat to celebrate the spirit of house music. Our residency is on Instagram at HouseCultureNet, so if you don't already, head on over there to grab yourself a place on the virtual dance floor with over 100,000 other party people. And if club culture conversations are your thing, don't forget to dive into the depths of our huge back catalogue of over 50 episodes, featuring voices as diverse as Britain's fiercest drag queen DJ Jodie Harsh, house music super producers Medusa, recent Grammy Award winner Purple Disco Machine, and genuine superstar DJs such as Paul Oakenfold, Fatboy Slim and Roger Sanchez. Whatever era of dance music you are into, we have got you covered. In this episode, we sit down with a DJ, producer and remixer who has had huge success bringing back classic melodies for the modern dance floor, as well as creating massive anthems that have achieved well over a billion streams worldwide. It's the one and only Topic. In this chat, you'll hear how scary it can be to make that transition from the studio desk to the DJ booth.
From being in a studio, being alone, no one's watching you and everything, to go on stage and to have like the full intention of everyone. Yeah, in the beginning, that was definitely intimidating or almost.
How you should never dismiss your own creations.
That's also how Breaking Me came about. We didn't really were hyped about the song, actually. But then, like 3 months later, we went to Miami and we were like, I think we underestimated that song. Maybe we should finish it now. And then 6-7 weeks later, the song was released.
What it's like to have a massive hit single during the pandemic.
It was really crazy to have like a global hit and not seeing it perform live. And the first time I did play it was an exit festival in Serbia. And that was over 18 months after the release of Breaking Me.
And his thoughts on why the dance music community is so special.
I think all the people in the dance music are very open-minded. It's like no matter who you are, you're always very welcome and it doesn't matter where you're from. And that's what I really, really enjoy about dance music.
I hope you enjoy this one. This is Topic.
House Culture.
Hi, Topic. It's great to have you on the House Culture Podcast today. You are an artist that burst onto the scene in 2014 and has never looked back since. You've released a huge number of club bangers since then, with a massive single, Breaking Me, having achieved over a billion worldwide streams. You have a very specific sound and have collaborated with some huge stars along the way. However, we always want to start at the beginning and understand how you got to where you are today. So can you tell us whereabouts you grew up and how you first discovered dance music there?
So I grew up in Germany, and I'm coming from a not very musical family, actually. None of my brothers or sisters played any instruments back then, nor my parents. I think my mom went to a choir class in school. That's about it. And yeah, at some point when I was 15 or 16, our music teacher decided to show us the software Logic. And for some reason, I really loved it. And in the beginning, I loved the technical part and not really liked the music. I just liked to discover the software. And then once you got into it, all your possibilities to go, you can do whatever you want. And I think that's what really fascinated me in the beginning, that when you had a PlayStation game, you were very limited in what you can do. And with Logic, there is no limits. And yeah, then from then on, I stopped playing PlayStation. And after school, I always went to my laptop and tried stuff on Logic.
No way. So you were actually creating music and creating things in Logic before you were even old enough to go out and clubbing and experience the kind of dance music scene in that sense?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in the beginning, I was also more into hip-hop music. And so I started kind of making hip-hop beats. But I always loved dance music, so I always tried it a little bit. But the problem was, back then I had so many friends who wanted to become rappers, and then I had a studio, and then I was always making beats and recording them. So there was not so much time always for making dance music. That came a few years later then.
And how much success did you have with doing the hip hop side of things? Were you just producing tracks with your friends, did you say, or was it like you were releasing stuff and getting some success there?
Yeah, I mean, in the beginning, it was definitely mostly for my friends or for local rappers that heard that, all right, that guy has a studio and he can make beats. And then also like stranger people came to me and I worked with them, or I connected with some people on MySpace back then. And then I invited them to my studio. But that was not really successful back then. I mean, there were some songs that kind of got viral on MySpace, but it was mostly local and kind of like in town.
And so whereabouts in Germany was it that you grew up?
I grew up close to Düsseldorf and Cologne, like in between of those big cities. Yeah, a small town.
And what was the clubbing scene like there? I mean, you said you were into hip-hop and making beats. What was the point where you started to go and experience dance music? How did you discover that?
I mean, I always, like when I heard it on the radio or sometimes like on house parties, I always liked it and I had an ear for it. But when I really got into it was, I think, from the Tomorrowland After movie, 2012. That was really like where the world of dance music opened up for me, and where I kind of like saw, okay, there are DJs, they are artists, they are putting out their music. And then I just kind of dived into it and discovered like Avicii, Swedish House Mafia, Skrillex and Alesso and all those guys, which were like big back then.
And so what would you say was kind of your breakthrough in terms of dance music? I mean, you know, your track Light It Up was the one that you know, seems to be the one that really propelled your career. I mean, was there anything kind of before that you were kind of getting traction with that you thought, hang on, this is something that I can really go with?
Oh, before that, there was the hip hop time where I produced stuff, which then eventually in 2013 and 14 got kind of successful. I produced an album which went into the charts for an artist, and that was the first time that I went to the official German charts. And then, like, I don't know, half a year later, I just decided, why not put out a song under my name? Because I was really doing more and more house productions, and just also like random instrumentals and beats. And at some point I had one instrumental that I really liked. And then I asked Jona Zelle, who was the singer from Light It Up. Mm-hmm. I asked him if he wants to try it with me and if we should meet and just try to write a song and on the instrumental. And we did that. I don't know, 3 weeks later, I just put it out on YouTube, Spotify, iTunes, and it didn't got super successful, but it definitely got kind of viral on YouTube. And I also, my best friend back then, she's a big YouTuber, and she put it in her videos and her travel vlogs. And yeah, that definitely also helped to get it viral. But that was my first single and my first step into the dance music world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And were you finding anyone was any of the, you know, you mentioned some of the like Avicii and Swedish House Mafia. Was there anyone that was picking up on this track that was playing it? Did you see it out there in the wild and like anyone kind of, put it in their sets or anything like that? And how did that feel?
No, actually, I didn't see any DJs picking it up in the beginning.
Uh-huh.
I was kind of mad also because the song had kind of YouTube clicks and no radio wanted to play it, and it was also on the iTunes charts, always like in the top 30.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason that track never got played by the radio or something. But I think it was because at the end of 2014 this progressive house style almost died out.
Mm-hmm.
And that track came a little bit too late probably for that style.
Yeah. So what was the kind of next step after that then, you know, in terms of the success that you'd had virally, what did you think? Did you have a game plan in terms of what you wanted to do next, or were you just keeping producing and seeing how things went?
I caught attention from an independent label or like distribution company, and they wanted to do an album with me then, like after Light It Up.
Mm-hmm.
And they offered me an advance and like budget for videos, and for me that was amazing because on the first single I had all the risk on my hands. I shot a music video, did some marketing, and I put kind of like all the money I had, which was not much back then, maybe like 4,000 euro or something, I put it in that project.
Mm-hmm.
And it could very well have happened that no one would like that song, and that I would have sit on that course forever. But then they offered me that. I did an album.
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of had the same story as Light It Up. It was not really recognized by the radios, not really put into Spotify playlists or anything. But then I think it went in the top 50 of the German album charts. So that's definitely a little bit of a success. And it was kind of like my first step into the chart world. Mm-hmm. And then I think it was like 3 or 4 months later, I released the first single after the album.
Mm-hmm.
That was my single Home with Nico Santos. And mm-hmm. that song then finally went crazy on the radio and went in all the Spotify playlists you can imagine. And that was then the first real one that also like DJs I saw in the 2001 track list, that like many DJs started to play it live. And that was finally my real first step in the dance music world.
Yeah, and I mean, like, we've spoken to a lot of artists and DJs and producers on this podcast, and you know, some are saying their judgment for success was when they first heard it on the radio themselves, or when they were sent like a video clip by one of their friends of some DJ playing it in a club or something like that. What did you have any of those moments where you thought, oh, you know, this is incredible, that like now it's really, really gaining traction?
Yeah, definitely. I would say the first one was when I saw it or heard it on the radio. Mm-hmm. I was in a restaurant, and I knew that a big radio station of in Germany is always on in that restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And then I entered, just sat down on my table, and then the song went on. And then I knew, okay, if they are playing it at this time, because it was also like, it's kind of like 5 p.m. or something during the week.
Mm-hmm.
then you know, like, okay, that's prime time, and they don't do a handpick one off at this time, you know. And that's when I knew, okay, I think we are having a hit here.
I mean, did you have to tell anyone when you heard that, when you were sat down, like, you'd be like to one of the waiters or something, like, this is me, or like any of your friends? Is there anything, any feeling like that?
It was funny because I was with Nico Santos, actually, singer of the song. Yeah, we were together there, and we were just like, wow, this is incredible. we're in the restaurant sitting down, and the song is coming up.
Amazing. And I mean, you know, the tracks that you've produced as well, they've taken like inspiration from a very specific era in kind of dance music. You know, I'm thinking of your versions of For an Angel, Kernkraft, and 9 PM Till I Come. You know, what is it about that kind of late 90s trance era that you love so much?
It's funny because those songs didn't really get me into dance music in the first place. But I remember when I was like really young, like 8 years, 9 years old, my parents always bought those compilations. Mm-hmm. And I bet all of those songs that I did, like 9 PM, Kernkraft 400, or For an Angel, they were probably on those CDs. Mm-hmm. And that's why I knew them like for my whole life, those melodies. And everything. And I remember when I was really young, I always put on those compilation discs and just like listened to through the whole disc and through every song. And sometimes just sat alone in the living room of my parents for like an hour or 2 hours, just like listening to all those songs. And I think that's why they're kind of special to me, even though I don't really have specific memories listening to 9 PM or to For an Angel, but it's just in me, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of your foundation, I suppose. I mean, for me, you know, it's an era that's very special, like close to my heart. Obviously, you know, I'm a little bit older, and, you know, I was there in the clubs, like hearing those tracks. And it's fantastic to see, like, and hear these young producers coming through like yourself that are, you know, paying reverence to these tracks from, you know, a specific part of time, and reintroducing people to those sounds and to those melodies and putting that fresh spin on it. I mean, as they were part of kind of, like you say, you were kind of growing up, did it frighten you taking on something that was so inherent in terms of your musical education, in terms of updating them? Or was it a fresh challenge to put your own spin on it?
I think it was just like very fresh. And for me, when I like all the songs I wrote was A7S on that. And we just go into the studio, and it's weird. We don't really say like, okay, that song was so big. And like, we don't visualize that it was so big back then. I think then we would get a lot of pressure and everything, but we just take it and open up Logic and just go with the flow and do what we like. And it's really like the same workflow as if we would just start a song from scratch, but only with a sample. It's like you already have like something in it, and then you just work around it, and it's basically the exact same process as doing a song from scratch.
And you know, your version of ATB as well, I mean, you worked with ATB to create that. How did that kind of partnership come about? Was it something that you wanted to create and ATB came in after, or was it the other way around? How did that work?
It was actually the other way around, because I was always really like, I don't want to do cover songs, I don't want to do sampling or remixes, I just always want to do original stuff. And then ATB asked me if I would wanted to do it, but then he already said like, we want to have a new song around it, and we don't want to just like make this song a little bit new and remix it. And then I thought like, okay, this that can be interesting. I love the melody, I love the sound of 9 PM. And then I spoke with A7S, he was also up for it. And yeah, then the first step was that I created an instrumental, like in my vibe a little bit, send it back to ATB. He worked a little bit on it. And then we went on Zoom, because it was during the pandemic, with A7S. He did his thing, did some melodies, some lyric ideas, and all that stuff. And then we put everything together that we had, kind of like the the whole top line. And then I worked a little bit on it, sent it back to ATB. He worked on it. And then we met one final time in the studio and did the song, finished the song together.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned the pandemic and the way people were working and producing tracks kind of during that era in terms of, you know, being all isolated and working in pockets and sharing things in that way. Is that how you like to kind of work now? Or do you prefer to all try and be together in the studio to collaborate and feed off each other? What's your kind of vibe when you're creating?
No, I actually hated the Zoom sessions. It's like you need the connection to be with someone in the studio. Mm-hmm. I mean, with A7S and me, it definitely works because we worked on so many songs together and we just know how we are. And that's why with him it's okay to be on Zoom, but I would definitely say, like, being in the room, and there's a certain magic of being in the room with someone, with other musicians, songwriters, producers, and that's what you don't get with Zoom, unfortunately.
Yeah, totally get that. And, you know, we have mentioned obviously that you know, taking on what can be seen as classic tracks. You know, are there any other kind of tracks from that era that you're like got your eye on and that you would love to try and take on and update to a new audience?
And not yet. I think most of the ones that I liked are already done, either by me or by someone else. And I don't know. I also don't want to overdo it. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be that guy who takes stuff from the 90s always and make something new with it, but you never know, maybe in 2 years I will find something from 2010 which is cool. I mean, at that time there were also many great melodies and great songs, so you never know.
Cool. And I mean, you've mentioned A7S, and obviously your most, you know, one of your most well-known tunes that I mentioned at the top of this has achieved over 1 billion streams worldwide. I mean, you know, that's just to hear that number, it's crazy. You know, it's breaking me. How did you guys meet, and how did that track specifically kind of come together?
So we met in Sweden in 2017. Mm-hmm. And it was just like a random songwriting session. I went to Sweden for a week to meet with some songwriters. And and then we just met in a studio and had a cool session. And from then on, we just we connected very well and always stayed in touch. Always when I came back to Sweden, I've met with him. And it was always amazing working with him. And after like 1 or 2 years, we started meeting more, going on songwriting trips together, and then also becoming like very close friends, actually. Mm-hmm. And then we kind of like worked every 2 or 3 months. We traveled somewhere together and worked on songs. Mm-hmm. And that's also how Breaking Me came about. We were traveling both to Berlin, actually, and there we had a session, and that was in summer of 2019. And at first we didn't really were hyped about the song, actually. We just had like some of the melodies, and that was it. And we didn't have any lyric ideas or anything. But then like 3 months later, we went to Miami for also like a songwriting trip, and we put back on the project of Breaking Me, and we were really like, I think we underestimated that song. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should finish it now. And then we finished it in Miami, recorded it. And then, like 6-7 weeks later, the song was already released.
Yeah. And, you know, that you've described it yourself as melancholy dance music. I mean, it's not often that you hear dance music that is kind of introspective in that way. I mean, is that the sound you were trying to create when you set out to make that track, in terms of it being having that kind of melancholy feel?
Yeah, definitely. It's weird. I always liked melancholic songs when even when I was a kid. I always like sad songs for some reason, even though I'm not a very melancholic person, it just makes me happy to listen to sad songs. That's why I always had a struggle in the beginning of finding my sound, because, you know, as you said, like, dance music is always uplifting and it's not really like something melancholic. And that's why in the beginning it was really tough for me to find something that's uplifting, but also that is melancholic. And then after a few years now, I definitely know how to create that vibe, to have like a melancholic thing in it, but also, yeah, like the uplifting touch that you can still play it on festivals.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it came out during the pandemic as well. I mean, were you surprised at its success? You know, you kind of said that you revisited the track and then you realized, you know, it's going to be a big one. You know, obviously it was released during that period. And what has it been pleasurable to be able to play it to live audiences again now and to see that kind of reaction? Just talk us through that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it was really crazy to have like a global hit and not seeing it perform live and not seeing the reaction of the people. And I mean, I saw it a little bit because many people tagged me on Instagram when they were listening to it. But yeah, definitely was a weird thing to not be able to play your biggest song of your life. And the first time I did play it was in at the Exit Festival in Serbia. Mm-hmm. That was kind of like the first festival after the pandemic. And that was over 18 months after the release of Breaking Me. But it was definitely a great feeling to finally see people singing that song.
So when you're playing, and you mentioned it was 18 months since that had been released, when you were actually going out and playing live again, had you built up amassed a whole bunch of tunes over those 18 months that you really wanted to play out live? Or were you like being mindful of, no, I've got to keep things fresh and up front for the audience? You know, how did you kind of manage that performance playlist that you had when you were back out there after the pandemic?
Actually, I'm always a guy who does things at the latest point possible. Like my deadlines are always like the last 1 or 2 days I always go crazy because I didn't do anything. And luckily there was also the case with the set list. Mm-hmm. I just had like 2 sleepless nights before the festival because I had to finish all the songs and I like find new fresh stuff, find new mashups to make. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that was two days before the festival that I started.
No way. And so, you know, and you've mentioned A7S like a few times as well, and obviously, you know, that's who you collaborated with for Breaking Me. I mean, you know, how do you guys kind of work together? Who looks after what, and how do you manage any kind of disagreements in the studios? Is it an easy flow between you, or is there often an argument, a point of friction? Like, how do you collaborate?
No, it's usually, there's not really friction points, but I mean, of course there are many friction points, but we are kind of fast and like agreeing what's good and what's bad, and like no one is pissed off if I say that's not good, or if he's saying this is not so good. We are always kind of like objective about it, and that's really good. And in terms of who's doing what, he's more of a songwriter and lyric writer, and I'm more the producer. So we are doing always both at the same time. Like I'm always starting production, he's always starting like with some melodies, and that's how we are building the song up over the session. Mm-hmm. And so that's why after a session we usually have kind of like a finished song with the finished production, or not like finished production, but the finished demo production that you already can hear like where the song is about to go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And are you kind of a perfectionist in the studio, or are you happy to take things out and kind of road test them and judge an audience reaction, then go back into the studio and tweak things? How do you operate in that way?
I think we are less perfectionist than we think we are. because we kind of like, once we do something we like, we stick to it and don't go crazy about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can get a little bit perfectionist about the production to go into it and fix like small details all the time. But also over the time now, I'm getting less in that because I'm just realizing how you don't realize all the, or like that the crowd is not realizing if you do like those minor changes mm-hmm. all the time. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm kind of like, yeah, more chill about it.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Cool. And you know, in terms of, you know, it sounds like through kind of your journey as well, it's been more kind of production based and then a transition into kind of performance and DJing. I mean, was that transition daunting at any stage? You know, if you're a, I'd imagine being an in-house in studio kind of producer and then suddenly you're in front of a live audience, you know, how, did you find that daunting in any way?
Oh, definitely. It was definitely like a hard crossover, like from being in a studio, being alone, no one's watching you and everything, to go on stage and to have like the full intention of everyone. And yeah, in the beginning, that was definitely, yeah, intimidating or almost. Mm. And so in the beginning, I also was always kind of like drinking a little bit before the show mm-hmm. to get like a little bit eased off. but I'm very happy that I don't have to do that anymore, because I think with all the shows I have now, it would be not very healthy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, do you still get nervous? Is nerves a good thing for you?
I always like to say I'm getting excited and not nervous.
It's a good way of looking at it, definitely. I mean, we've spoken to Purple Disco Machine on this podcast, and he said that, you know, his personality was much more suited to being in the studio. You know, what do you kind of prefer in terms of that performance aspect? Do you like being behind the decks in front of that audience so you can like give a performance, or do you prefer like, no, I want to get my head down behind a mixing desk?
1 year ago, I would have said definitely the studio, but right now I'm saying it's 50-50 actually, because now I just had like the craziest summer tour with all around Europe, no sleep all the time. But what happens then is like you play so many different songs and different festivals, and you get so much new inspiration for new music. Mm-hmm. And that's why I would definitely say now I need both, even though I kind of like it more to be in the studio and to have like a fixed day schedule and regular sleep. The studio time now gets a lot of more fun because I know how it is live, and now I can sit down today, produce a song which I will play on Friday. Mm-hmm. And that's also kind of like more say motivating.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
It, you know, okay, if I finish that song now, I can play it tomorrow and see people dancing to it and not like before that in the pandemic, it was kind of like, okay, if I finish it now, then I just upload it in my Dropbox and who knows what's going to happen with it. Mm. Who's going to hear maybe a few friends and then that's it. Yeah. But now it's a different story.
And I can see you're in your studio right now. Whereabouts is that? Like, where are you based?
I'm now based in Dubai. Mm-hmm. I've moved here in the beginning of 2021. And but I'm now back. The last 3 months I was in Europe. Mm-hmm. And now I finally got back here for a week. And have like studio time on my own, get good sleep, train, and have good food.
Right, and I want to talk about remixes as well. So, you're like a triple threat in terms of production, DJ, remixer. Also, you know, you've remixed people like Medusa, who we've spoken to on the podcast. I mean, when those remixes come through to you, what are you trying to achieve in those? How much of the original are you trying to maintain, and how much of your own sound are you trying to inject?
I think the most important one is to put your sound in it. Mm-hmm. Because if you just keep too much of the original, it's almost like, you would ask like, why doing a remix at all? So I always just try to put as much topic in it as possible.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned your album as well, released back in 2015, I think. Can we expect a follow-up on that? Are you working on anything right now that's moving towards an album? I mean, we've spoken to a lot of artists and, you know, some people love the idea of a fully encapsulated album that has, you know, a beginning, middle and end and tells a story. And other artists are kind of like, no, I'm just interested in releasing singles for the dance floor. Like, how do you sit on that? And how would you approach it?
I'm definitely a really big fan of albums and also mm-hmm. of the whole process and making it and creating it. But unfortunately, like the audience is not really there anymore. And also the labels are not really interested in doing that because, you know, they just want to have what's most profitable. Yes. Yeah, that's why it's kind of hard to convince them mm-hmm. to make an album. They want to have like a big single with it and all that stuff what label wants. But I don't know, for me, I'm just in the process of creating just many songs right now, and songs for the dance floor, songs for the radio. And that's my main focus right now. Mm-hmm. And if it's going to be an album at some point, then I'm happy. And if not, then it's just going to be a lot of singles, which is also fine as long as it's going to be released and people are about to hear it.
Yeah, yeah. And is there ever a temptation to, you know, hark back to that era of when you were producing, you know, slower stuff, like more hip hop stuff? You know, is there ever a temptation to go and produce a bit more of that again, or feed that into your music like you're producing now?
Not for my project. I mean, I am actually doing it for other artists. I'm still a producer for various different singers. Mm-hmm. But for me right now, I don't see it coming back to make slower stuff. Mm-hmm. But also, you never know. Maybe in a few years, I'm older and I'm like, okay, let's make now chill out music. you never know what happens. I'm always going with what I like the most. But right now, I'm really like, okay, I want to make stuff that works on the dance floor, that gets people dancing and people hyped. This is my main motivation right now.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you've mentioned, you know, your packed diary. And what have you got kind of coming up that you're looking forward to, that you're most excited about? And, you know, what kind of places are you going to you might not have been before, or places that you'd like to go that you haven't been? What's kind of in your diary?
We are just setting up a new America tour, North America. I've been there last year already, but I really enjoyed it. And it's definitely nice after the European summer to go to the States, because it's such a different vibe and the people are so different there. Mm-hmm. And the venues are also so good. And I really enjoyed it. So I'm definitely looking forward to that. And for late autumn, winter, we are still figuring out if I can go to Asia. That would be amazing because in Asia, I only have been one time, like on my own for holiday. Mm-hmm. And it would be amazing to like go there, see different countries, play festivals in Asia. And that's what I'm looking forward to most.
Yeah, and those different crowds in different places, you know, you mentioned that you've played in America, and you know, do you have to find, you have to tailor what you're doing in terms of the audience there? How do you approach that?
Oh yeah, sure. It's definitely a different audience there, and some songs that work very well in Europe doesn't work at all in the States. Mm-hmm. And that's why you have to really figure out what the venue is, what the night is also, and then see what the crowd reaction is. So when I toured in the US, it was also like from venue to venue really like different. And so here in Europe right now, I'm kind of having like a fixed set list. Mm-hmm. Like maybe I play from 40 songs, 25 always right now. Mm-hmm. But if I would go to the US, I would probably pack like 70 or 80 songs and only play 25 to have more options where I can go to.
Yeah. And so, you know, doing that kind of semi gig research, I mean, do you like to absorb the vibe in the club before your set just to kind of see what's going on? Or do you just want to just blast in, open the doors and just do your thing?
Yeah, I usually like to be in the club or at the venue 1 hour before my set time. Mm-hmm. Because then you already hear the music, you hear the crowd, and I don't know, you kind of get settled in better than if I would only like arrive 2 minutes later on the stage. That would be maybe too much for me.
Yeah. Yeah, to try and hit the ground running in that way. So, you know, and you mentioned like having the playlist that you've got, you know, you like kind of the record box of tracks that you're going to choose from. So, you know, we're going to move on now to talk about the House Culture Perfect playlist, which is on Spotify. And we've got your five tracks from the five different themes that we always have. And every single one of our podcast guests has submitted tracks for this playlist. It's huge. It's over 24 hours long, and it's got some, you know, brilliant, brilliant tracks in there. Some really well known, some obscurities, you know, everything's completely chosen by our guests. So, you know, I'm going to remind you what you've chosen as we go through them, because the different themes that we've got. So, and we always start off with a catalyst tune, a track that got you into dance music, and you have chosen Alesso and Years. Can you just tell us why that came to your top of mind when we're asking you for this choice? What does it, you know, tell us about your experience with that tune.
Yeah, I mean, that song was kind of released late. I think it was 2011 or 2012. Mm-hmm. So it was obviously not my first dance song that I listened to. Mm-hmm. But it was the first one that I really researched about it, and like I wanted to know who's the artist and how did he produce it. And then I went on YouTube already and like looked up of tutorials how to make that style. And that's why I always say that song really sticks out, because before that song I was only listening to dance music like just on the go and just like, oh, this song is cool, I'm gonna listen to that, but not more. But Alesso Years was really the first one that I was really hyped about it, and I saw like, okay, that is very cool and I want to do something like this too.
Yeah, and like you mentioned there, like going onto YouTube and researching it, how as an artist and producer, how are you learning all the time? Are you absorbing and researching all of these different sounds and different ways to produce? Like how does that work for you?
Yeah, YouTube is amazing. I mean, you have so many great tutorials, so many guys doing just like amazing stuff in education and samples and preset banks and all sort of stuff. So the internet is just like the best teacher, I think, to learn music production. I would definitely say don't spend crazy amount of money for going on to some production schools, because your YouTube teachers are a lot better than like those teachers on schools.
Yes, great advice. Okay, so and the next track for our playlist is The Floor Filler. And you've chosen your track with A7S, Kernkraft 400, A Better Day. We've kind of touched on it a little bit, but, you know, how did that, why is that a floor filler for you? Obviously, it's your own track and people expect to hear it. But tell us about how that kind of came together and why you chose that for us.
Yeah, I mean, we got to give credit to Zombie Nation here. I mean, the song was already a floor filler before it was released. Mm-hmm. So it's just a sample and that melody, which is like, it's crazy. Like you put it on no matter where you are. You're in Australia, you're in the States, you're in Germany or wherever. People know that and go crazy. Mm-hmm. And you also get the crowd singing like immediately.
Yeah.
And that's just so sick with that song.
Yeah, yeah, brilliant. Okay, and a sunsetter you've chosen, a track that could soundtrack a sunset is Milo AO Technology. Just tell us about that.
Yeah, it was funny because the song is kind of old now. And I chose the track list, I think, 1 or 2 days after I saw him live. We were both on a award show, mm-hmm. and he got invited to like play the closing, and then he played that song as last song, and I was really like getting like old memories back from when I was 16, 17, and I really liked listening to that song in any way. Like sometimes we listened to it before we went to the club with friends. And even though it's just an acoustic song, it had so much energy, and people always loved it. Yeah,
yeah, it's a beauty. Okay, so a tearjerker. You have chosen "Don't Worry, Child." "Don't You Worry, Child" by Swedish House Mafia. Why is that so meaningful in terms of a tearjerker for you?
Yeah, I was also thinking of putting that song into the Years Are Lesser song because. Mm-hmm. That song means even more to me in terms of getting into music, into dance music. And it was also kind of like not too long after I discovered Years by Alesso, that song came out. And then like I was really into dance music and I thought this is the coolest thing in the world right now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that also has like those melancholic vibes in it. And this is why I love it so much, because it's such a good song. It's so well written. Mm-hmm. And John Martin is singing it also like so good. And then you have like this big production, which still 10 years now sounds like fresh and new.
Yeah.
And that's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's nuts. It's nuts. It still does the damage on the dance floor when you hear that. So a last tune is... Crowd Are Calling For One More. What do you play? And we've already really talked about this, but you've chosen Breaking Me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of that, do you feel as an artist like a bit of a pressure to deliver the familiar tracks that people, you know that you've produced when you're playing a gig? Because we've spoken to a few people that were kind of like, oh, you know, sometimes, you know, we might not play like the one that people expect us to play and people get upset, or you know, do you feel like you have to play it, or do you sometimes be like, oh no, I really want to?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, because sometimes I do feel like, oh god, if I play Breaking Me now, it's so boring, and like, oh, I can't hear it anymore. But then you have to remember, it's not the same crowd on your summer tour every night. Mm-hmm. So they're like 90% of the people there, or maybe 95% of the people there, see me for the first times in their lives. And for them, it's like new and fresh and they really want to hear it.
Yeah.
So I always have to keep that in mind when I'm like, oh, I don't want to play that song again. And then you have to remind yourself like, yeah, the last 4 days you played every night and you played it. And of course, for me, it's old, but not for the people in the crowd, of course. So we will see how I think about it in 5 years, about Breaking Life. But I guess that song won't leave my sets for my whole life anymore. Mm. What I like to do, what I'm still doing actually, is to make different edits with it. And last week I played Tomorrowland main stage, and I actually played a new mashup from Your Love 9 PM, mm-hmm. or like a new production on it. Like I produced a whole live version of it, which is not released and which probably won't be released also. And this is what I like, and to tweak it a little bit over the time, make it more fresh over the years. And I think this is the way to go also with Breaking Me. Right now I'm still playing it with a mashup of a song by David Guetta and Morten. Mm-hmm. But I think in the winter now I will probably make a new live edit myself with Breaking Me.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, I mean, just keep it fresh for not only for yourself, but for the crowd as well. And you're still giving them an element of what they want, I think is the way to go.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, this is the end of the interview. So we always end up with one final question that we always ask our guests, which is, you know, we are house culture and we are all about the scene, the community, the DJs, producers, club owners, promoters, everyone behind the scenes. You know, and obviously you are a huge part of that now and massive success in terms of what you've been doing. When you take a step back and look at what you've achieved and what it's given you in your life, what does the dance music and house music community kind of mean to you?
Oh, that's a really cool question, because a few days ago I was talking with a friend about where do you feel most comfortable with which people, like what is the nationality, is it like a country, city? Mm-hmm. And then he said like a country and a vibe, but then I was saying I actually feel most comfortable on when I'm with people from the dance music, like on festivals and on clubs. Mm-hmm. Because I think all the people in the dance music are very open-minded, and it's like no matter who you are, you're always very welcome, and it doesn't matter where you're from. And that's always like a nice feeling on those festivals or in clubs when you meet the promoters and you're having dinner. Like it feels like a very small world, but a very like accepting and cool world. And that's what I really, really enjoy about dance music.
Perfect. No, that's a brilliant final thought to end on. That's fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you, man.
House culture.
That was fascinating, wasn't it? Really interesting to hear how the new breed of DJs and producers are making their mark in dance music. And if you want to get some more topic in your life, his latest single called All or Nothing sees him making sonic synergy with vocalist Harvey, and is available on all streaming platforms now. As we're talking about tracks, don't forget that you can find the House Culture Perfect playlist on Spotify. This is the home for all of our interviewees' thematic submissions, and is an absolute beast of banging beats. So make sure you give it a follow, stick it on shuffle, and turn it up loud. Then with that as your soundtrack, please do all of that other good stuff for us. Loving, liking, tweeting, and sharing. This podcast is one of the most shared in the world. So pass the message on to that neighbour of yours on the dance floor. We also love to hear your feedback. So whether that's in a review on Apple Podcasts or a comment on our Insta, please get in touch and we'll make sure to give those kind words some recognition on a future episode. This time around, I'd like to say a big shout out to DJ Matt Hall, who loved listening to our last episode featuring Judge Jules, and that the judge's sage advice has, when Matt's DJing, inspired him to maintain eye contact with the crowd on the dance floor rather than on his laptop. I'm so pleased to hear that, Matt, and I hope it makes for a more positive approach when playing live. If you, dear listener, would like to see more of what we do, make sure you follow us on Instagram at HouseCultureNet or by following the hashtag TrueHouseCulture. Or if you want to get in touch with me directly, you can do that on Instagram at DJ Matt Rouse. Thanks for listening. Rave safe and see you next time.
House Culture.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.